sort of interjecting this lesson in the lessons that Rick has been doing on Proverbs about the tongue and our speech. I think he'll finish that up on Sunday morning, Lord willing, or continue that. But since he's out of town, it gives us an opportunity to talk about, as you see, anger, contention, and strife. And as what we'll find out is actually this dovetails pretty nicely with what we've been talking about for the last three or four classes. More often than not, and we'll see that tonight as we go through this, all these proverbs about anger, contention, and strife, when we talk about application to ourselves, more often than not, they're going to be manifested in our speech or how we use our tongue. So I think we'll find that this lesson fits in pretty nicely. It won't step on too much of what Rick has talked about, but I hope it will add to it. I didn't have it on the title of the handout, but you can see on the bottom there were several proverbs there listed about pride. If time permits us at the end of this discussion, we'll move right on into that. That's another one of those topics that probably didn't have enough for a whole class, but while we're talking about some of these negative attributes, we might as well throw another one in there. So tonight we'll talk about anger, contention, and strife. As you look at these terms in Proverbs, there's several different definitions for how these words are defined, and they're all just a little subtly different. We'll keep it fairly general, pretty much contained in the context of each little proverb. In fact, with contention and strife, several times these proverbs or these words, as you look at the word that's used in the Hebrew, is actually the definition of it. For contention will be strife, and the definition of strife will be contention. But we'll find that there's some subtle differences, and in fact, we'll have a point specifically dealing with that. But let's understand what we're talking about first. When we talk about anger, we're talking about strong displeasure, wrath, fierceness, heated. The actual word many times is used. There's associated with it the idea of nostril or snorting. You get the idea there when you talk about anger. That fierce kind of explosion. You know, you see that facial expression, and you just kind of like a wild animal or something like that. A fierceness there associated with anger. So I found that to be interesting. Contention is how we're going to see it used mostly in the context of these proverbs. Is that of arguing or making an argument to contend? Usually making a useless argument or an argument just for the sake of arguing. And strife is the idea of struggle or conflict. Discord, it's not peaceful. It's not peaceful is what we're going to find out, and the disadvantages associated with that. Interestingly enough, all of these words we can find used other places in the Bible or very similar to these words where they're not used in a negative sense, like anger in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 and 27. It says, be angry and sin not. You know, take care of that anger. And we have examples of where you can see that Jesus was pretty heated in some of his dealings. Paul was pretty heated with Elymas the sorcerer when he wouldn't leave the man alone that he was trying to convert. So we can see that anger is used in not necessarily a negative sense. But tonight, most of what we're going to see is going to be that of anger, sort of a fierce outburst. It is going to be in a negative sense. Contention, a familiar passage in Jude 3, is contend earnestly for the faith. Not the exact word, but a similar one. Again, there's times that we need to fight and argue, and we're justified in doing that. But that's not the kind of contention we're going to be talking about tonight. And strife, we have a similar word, strive. In Luke chapter 13, Jesus says, strive to enter in the narrow gate. And the word behind that strive is actually that of agonize or try with all you can. And it's a similar definition to what we're talking about with strife. There's some struggle there. There's some conflict there. But when we talk about strife tonight, it's obviously going to be in the negative sense. So just a few definition of terms so we all know what we're talking about. First, we'll talk about anger. And let's look at some descriptions of the angry man. It says, a wise man fears and departs from evil. A fool rages in his self-confidence. And then it goes on to say, a quick-tempered man acts foolishly. The next one, he who is slow to wrath has great understanding, but he who is impulsive exalts folly. A wrathful man stirs up strife, But he is slow, who is slow to anger allays contention. A couple more. He who is slow to anger, again, is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. And the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger. As we look at these descriptions, somebody tell me, and you may see other things there, but well, what is something that's in common with all these passages either describe negatively about the angry man or the man that is slow to anger? What's one thing they have in common? I'll tell you what I thought. The angry man is out of control. The angry man sets aside rational thought, and to some degree he's out of control. As we look back at some of those first ones there, the fool rages and is self-confident, where the wise man, he's got enough head, even if somebody's done him wrong, to see when danger lies ahead and when he needs to calm down, when he needs to divert and avoid before he gets himself in trouble. Same thing about the quick-tempered man. He acts foolishly. The impulsive man exalts folly. The man who is slow to anger allays contention. He alleviates contention before it gets started. Again, slow to anger. He's better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit, who takes a city. That's the power of a man who can control his temper, who doesn't lose control of his thought processes and just act emotionally. And the same thing expressed there in 1911, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger. So the idea is that an angry man is out of control. Because what's driving the angry man? Is he thinking clearly? What's he thinking about? Well, he's not thinking at all. What's he driven by? He's driven by what? That emotion. That emotion of somebody's done me wrong and I'm going to let somebody know about it, or I'm going to get back with them, I'm going to get even with them. That's what drives the angry man. Think about the story of David and Nabal and Abigail. If you remember that story, and I think it's 1 Samuel chapter 25, David goes to Nabal as he's having a feast for his shears, and he says, you know, let us have some of the provisions. We've been good to you. And Nabal, of course, just spurns him and says, many, many slaves run away from their master. Who are you and why am I going to give you things? Well, David's men report that back to David, and David immediately says, everybody get your sword. And he gets his sword, and they move out. Well, a message comes to Abigail. She loads up a bunch of supplies. She goes down there, and she falls on her face in front of David, and she says, David, I'm sorry. This is my fault. I didn't know that you had come. Please don't do what you're planning to do. She says, you know, I know you're coming for bloodshed to avenge yourself. And she even makes the point that God is with you. Before long, you will be ruler of Israel. And when that happens, you don't want to regret the action that you're about to take. And David realizes that. At the end of her little speech there about that, he says, blessed is God for sending you to me, and blessed are you for bringing that to my attention, because just as sure as can be, if you had not have come, every male of Nabal's house was going to be killed by morning. And you've kept me from regretting that. And he states that pretty explicitly. But two examples of what we see here both. David was angry and was about to do something he was going to regret. He wasn't thinking everything through all the way. He hadn't left himself some time to recover from what had happened to him. Abigail was one that used discretion, slow to anger, and ruled her spirit. And she was able to thwart a military confrontation because she ruled well her spirit. Instead of getting up there and say, David, I see what you're trying to do, and Nabal's going to come and fight, and, you know, and just escalate from there. So we can see a good example there of the angry man not being in control of his emotions or his thoughts. And the one that is slow to anger, well, he has more control to think things out. Some other examples that we won't take the time to look at, but, you know, Stephen, when Stephen brings his sermon to a close, those people get very angry. They listen to him, and then they stop, and they gnash on him with their teeth. And then after that, they stop their ears. They literally stop their ears, and they run on him, and they stone him. Again, totally out of control. The same thing with Paul, when he is confronted with Demetrius the silversmith, that whole riot in the city of Ephesus there. A lot of those people didn't even know why they were rioting, but they were just there shouting, great is Diana of the Ephesians. They were out of control. And the proconsul there, or the governor there, chided them. He said, "You're behaving very rashly," or the idea is you're not thinking about what you're doing. You're just acting on emotion. And the same thing when Paul gave his speech there after he had been taken prisoner there in Jerusalem initially. So good examples of people who were out of control when they became angry. How does that compare with how Christians are supposed to behave? What's a word or a trait or a characteristic that Christians are supposed to be? Gentle, that wasn't specifically what I was looking for, but that certainly fits the opposite of this angry or out of control. Christians are to be in control, right? They're supposed to have self-control, temperance. They're supposed to be sober. Yeah. They're supposed to be sober. They're supposed to be in control of their emotions. There are several passages that tell us about how Christians are to be temperate. In 1 Corinthians 9:25, Paul writes, you know, when we're competing, when a person competes, he's very temperate. He uses self-control as he prepares to compete. And that's, he was talking about a race. And he says, we're not talking about this perishable crown of a race, but an imperishable crown. As we strive for that goal of eternal life with God, we have to live a life of self-control, of being in control, both physically what we do and mentally how we think. In Galatians chapter 5, when he lists the fruit of the Spirit, again, that's one there. Temperance, self-control, and the fruit of the Spirit. A qualification for an elder in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2. Elder must be blameless. He must be temperate. He must be in control. James 1:19 tells us to be slow to speak, slow to wrath. And in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, verses 6 through 9 there, he actually says, you know, take diligence, add to your faith virtue, add to your virtue knowledge, add to knowledge temperance or self-control. And he sums that up after he lists that list there in verse 9 of 2 Peter chapter 1. He says, anybody that lacks these good qualities, they're short-sighted. They're short-sighted to blindness. They're not getting the big picture. It's very important as Christians for us to display self-control, especially when it comes to our temper. Because as we're going to see in the next point, and some of the consequences of anger, that self-control really is important. Any questions on this idea of the angry man being out of control?
A couple of weeks ago in our bulletin, says, one of the title, New Grudges and Bitterness. Holding a grudge has become a lifelong fight for some. They can remember every unkind word that was spoken to them. They dwell upon the way they were mistreated and make a pact to themselves never to forgive. Their attitude is one that says, now you hurt me and you must pay.
That's right. Now, see, that's a good point. And the man that holds a grudge or is plotting revenge, this long, stewing, brewing wrath of revenge that he wants to, he's just as much out of control as that man like David when he was done wrong by Nabal that explodes right away and says, I'm gonna do something about it right now. He may just be out of control for a much longer time. That whole time he's holding that grudge, he's not thinking rationally, but he's dominated by that emotion of getting even. Of getting revenge. That's a good point, buddy. Any other points on this idea of out of control, Wayne?
Now, this is stating the obvious, I guess, but all these verses say slow to anger. Slow to anger. It's making the journey come a little quicker.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point from an elder thinking about one of the reasons that's an elder qualification. Is something you need to be preparing for in advance, to be temperate and sober-minded. That's a good point, Wayne.
It's not a way of saying it's going to hurt you.
That's right.
It's controlling. You know, we used to say that a man is not in control with his brain or mind, that he's throwing his brain out of gear, and he was just coping.
Yeah.
And one of the other things of it is that anytime that you're angry and you take a blood sample, you'll find out that the consistency of the blood is different than when you're happy.
Really?
Therefore,
There's a marked change there. It's some physical manifestation that something is out of whack. He's out of control. He's not his normal self. Sure. That's right.
He was so furious that he killed himself.
That's right. So all three can be used in that example as an example of how people react to anger, whether they stay in control or whether they're slow to wrath. Good comments. Anything else? Let's talk about some of the consequences of uncontrolled anger. It says, a stone is heavy and sand is weighty, but a fool's wrath is heavier than them both. The idea is the fool is so irrational, there's no rhyme or reason to his anger, and it just comes down hard. There's no reasoning with him. This last part in verse 4, the point is how bad jealousy is, but it's a good description of wrath and anger. Wrath is cruel, anger is a torrent. And we'll see that again, that idea that anger is like somebody opened the floodgates and you're standing in front of it and you're trying to catch that water. It's not going to go very well. And if it's a big enough torrent, it's just going to knock you down and sweep you away. So that's the idea there. An angry man stirs up strife. A furious man abounds in transgression. We'll talk about that in just a second. A man of great wrath will suffer punishment, for if you rescue him, you'll have to do it again. Oftentimes, if somebody has that explosive temper or that brooding revenge, it's not going to go away. It's going to happen again and again until a concerted effort is made to get rid of that characteristic trait. So there's definitely consequences for that. Because the idea is that uncontrolled anger is unpredictable. It's unpredictable. It's really no different than as far as the control that you exert over yourself. It's no different than if you're drunk. If you get drunk, that alcohol takes away your rational reasoning and you do things you normally wouldn't do. When you let anger overtake you, you let it control you, you'll become unreasonable and you'll do things that you normally won't do. Or any other thing that would cause you to give up or relinquish that control. Anger is like that. If it's not controlled, you relinquish that power of controlling yourself. And as that second one says there, and a furious man abounds in transgression. When somebody is angry and they let that consume them, more often than not, where does it lead? It leads to sin. Sin of some sort or some sort of evil plotting, some sort of evil doing. Almost always, you think about the story of Cain. His sacrifice was unacceptable there in Genesis chapter 4. And God said, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fall? You know, if you do well, it will be good with you. But if not, what's waiting for you, Cain? Who's looking for you? Sin is. And its desire is for you. But you should rule over the sin, not the other way around. You should rule over that desire. And of course, we know the story of that. Cain did not do that. Samson. We've used Samson before in our lesson on friendship. You know, who would want to be the friend of Samson? Don't make friends with an angry man because he'll get you in trouble. And Samson, one thing that I found interesting Judges chapter 15, this is about the third act of violence that he partakes in. In verse 8 there, he makes the comment that after this is done, I'll stop. But like the last proverb says there, if you rescue him, you'll have to do it again. It never did stop with Samson. Now, understand that God was using Samson for a purpose. He certainly was. But God was also aware of Samson's particular personality traits that would lend itself to accomplish that purpose. Never stopped with Samson until it ended in his own end. But the angry man will always be punished. What are some dangers that we Christians face as far as sins that we can commit when we become angry? As we think of application for us. What sins are we in danger of if we become
speech?
Just what we've talked about in the last three or four classes here. Specifically in speech, we become foul-mouthed. We'll let loose some curses or something like that. Gossip. If somebody has wronged us, we're going to make sure that we're going to let other people know some of the things that they've done, whether they be true or not. Gossip and slander, things like that.
Some people revert to violence, anger, murder.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the biblical examples are. Hopefully, we expect most of the time that Christians, at least even in their uncontrolled anger, won't go that far. But there's certainly been cases of that. Certainly been cases of that. Violence, physical violence, even loss of life. Just very destructive, almost inevitably. Once we relinquish control of ourselves and our thought process, it's going to lead to some sort of evil or some sort of transgression. Any other comments or questions on this idea of anger and what it leads to, the consequences of not controlling our anger? Yeah, that's a good one. Withholding forgiveness, if anybody didn't hear that, withholding forgiveness from someone is another thing we can do when we let our anger get the best of us. But yeah, it's okay to be angry. There's situations where we will become angry, but we need to deal with that and take care of it and put it behind us and move on and not be participating in some of the sins it can lead to. Mr. Bowen? Yeah, we get in so deep that we can't back our way out. And actually, there's a little bit of pride involved in that. I don't know that we'll get to that tonight, but we get so angry at people that we get so far that we can't back out of some of the actions that we've committed because of that, or we're unwilling to do that. Any other comments or questions? Trevor?
Going back to the passage that Daniel mentioned in Ephesians 4:26, it's a quotation from Psalm 4. And the interesting thing there is, it says, be angry and do not sin, to be still upon your bed and to wait upon the Lord. And I think the interesting idea from that context is that oftentimes when we allow ourselves to get angry, what we're manifesting is a lack of faith. Where we should be waiting on God, letting Him to take care of this and letting Him deal with it. Instead, we're going out and acting upon ourselves. And so I think that's good motivation for self-examination, saying, why do I have this trouble with anger?
That's a real good point. We need to make sure that we're putting our trust in God, and when things don't go our way, we're not immediately trying to take matters into our own hands and make those right, and do so in an uncontrolled, angry fashion. Good comments. Yeah, well, like Wayne said a little while ago, it's something that you need to prepare yourself for, the idea of being slow to wrath. You're not going to feel that way when that situation comes on you. You have to be prepared, well-trained in it before you get to that. Any other comments or questions?
One thing I might remember that even though we get angry and we sin, say something or do something that we ought not, and we repent of it, maybe the people that we did the damage to, it might take them a long time to get over that. So
yeah. Even if the sin is no longer there, the evil, I guess I would call it an evil consequence of that interaction is still there. Still there. We still have to deal with that. Again, good comments. Let's look closely related, and a lot of times we'll find out that the anger also is related to these. The first point on contention and strife, and we'll kind of lump these together, is they're very similar words, but as you look at these proverbs here, you'll find out that the contention usually precedes strife, or the result of contention is strife. And again, when we talk about contention being arguing or picking a fight, something like that, and the end result of that is strife. It's discord, division, disunity, no peace. It says it's honorable for a man to stop striving because any fool can start a quarrel. Again, a wrathful man stirs up strife, but he is slow to anger, allays contention. Again, the idea is if the contention's not there, the resultant strife won't be there either. The beginning of strife is like releasing water. We saw that same thing with anger, somebody opening the gates of discord and disunity and just washing everything away. So before you get to that point, stop picking a fight. Stop arguing for the sake of arguing. Stop contention before a quarrel starts. Cast out the scoffer and contention will leave. The person there who's always running people down, making fun of people, saying bad things about people. You get rid of him and the instigating that he's doing, strife and reproach will cease. That won't be a problem. And we looked at this with some of our Proverbs on the speech. Where there's no wood, the fire goes out. Where there's no talebearer, strife ceases. And then elaborates on that. As charcoal is to burning coals and wood to fire, a contentious man, a man who's going to pick and argue for the sake of arguing, he's going to lead to discord and division and no peace. So that's how strife and contention are related. This idea of useless arguments or arguing for the sake of arguments. Think about the apostles. How many times did they argue about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom? And what did that matter? They argue about it more than one time. In fact, the last time they argue about it was within just a day before Jesus was taken away from them. And if you follow some of the accounts there, right after that is when Jesus sits down and he washes their feet. And he says, you know, you shouldn't be worrying about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. And that occasion where James and John's mom comes to Jesus and says, you know, give my sons this position of authority. And Jesus gives them the answer, and the ten hear it. And it says, boy, they were greatly displeased by that. They didn't like to hear that at all, that James and John might have some position of authority greater than them. Just these useless arguments that don't mean anything. Look over in First Timothy. We will take the time to look at these as we think about some application for ourselves. Because I want us to understand that there is an opportunity, or there is an occasion where we need to contend. There is an occasion where discord or disunity may be inevitable on doctrinal grounds. But look here, because this encloses both of them in the same passage. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, beginning verse 3, Paul writes, "As I urged you when I went to Macedonia, remain in Ephesus, that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies, which do what? Which cause disputes, rather than godly edification, which is in faith. Now the purpose of the commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith, which some have turned aside because they're doing what? They've turned aside to idle talk or useless talk, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say nor the things that they affirm. But we know," and I guess that's where I want to stop there, was verse 7. The idea is you tell these men to stop. You know, you, if necessary, contend with these men to stop this, put a stop to this, because the type of disputing and arguing that they're doing, it's just useless. The intention there is to create strife, to create division. They want to be teachers, so that's why they're doing this. But they don't understand what they're teaching. And also in 2 Timothy chapter 2, and beginning in verse 22, 2 Timothy 2, verse 22, again, kind of a similar thought, "Flee also youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition." That might involve some contending, some taking care of that when it's a doctrinal issue there. "If God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will." again, this idea of useless arguments, arguments that are not doctrinally based, they don't have anything to do with our doctrine, but they're just little petty things, and they drive wedges between us, and they can stir up a whole congregation. I don't know how many people have ever been in a congregation that hasn't had elders before, but sometimes you'll sit down in a men's meeting, and I've been in a congregation before where, boy, by the end of that men's meeting, you were wondering if these folks were really Christians or not. Just all sorts of contentious talk, and by the end, you've got different factions over here and different factions over there. And it was all about things about whether we should go to another building. What, you know, should we put new carpet in? Things like that. Things that didn't matter in the spiritual realm of things. And that's the real danger for Christians. When we're arguing with each other, is it over a doctrinal matter? Something that needs to be discussed? Something that needs to be ironed out? Or is it over something petty? Something that we want? Something that I want? Or something that you want? And if you don't like it, well, I'm going to cause trouble for you. And if you don't like it, you're going to cause trouble for me. Contention and strife, they go together pretty well. Any comments on contention and strife? We're still going to talk about strife a little bit here, but we'll kind of leave contention behind a bit. Okay. There's other sources of strife, and we won't spend much time on these because we've covered them for the most part in previous lessons or even earlier in this lesson. And there's just a passage or two on it. It says, hatred stirs up strife. Love covers all sins. Gossip or evil speech should be on there as well. A godly man digs up evil and it's on his lips like burning fire. The perverse man sows strife. A whisperer separates the best of friends. The idea is this man's going along, whatever he can do in his speech or his actions, he's trying to cause trouble. He's trying to get people on his side, or he's trying to alienate somebody from somebody else's side. So gossip and evil speech. Anger, that can go pretty closely with hatred, because the idea with anger and hatred, the intention there in acting on anger and hatred is to cause strife. You're trying to make life difficult for somebody because they've done something to you, or because you're mad at them. So anger and hatred go together. And pride, again, we're going to see more of this, probably not tonight, but some of those other passages, if we don't get a chance to get to it, we'll discuss this. But he who is of a proud heart stirs up strife, but he who trusts in the Lord will be prospered. The proud man is looking out for who? Looking out for himself, right? And so he's going to do whatever he can to make sure that's in his best interest. If that's building himself up or if that's tearing others down. But either way, that drives wedges. It creates discord and strife, as we're talking about. So those are just a few other things that cause strife. Let's look quickly tonight at the consequences of strife. And that will probably bring us pretty close to the end of class. Strife, just like anger, strife has consequences. He who passes by and meddles in a quarrel, not his own, is like one who takes a dog by the ears. I like that one. And Cousin Tiffany will appreciate this. I don't know if she knows this story about Cousin Jared or not, but my Cousin Jared was over at my house when we were young, and the nicest dog that I ever had in my life, had him for many years, never snapped or growled or did anything to anybody except to Cousin Jared one time. And when we asked him what he did, he goes, well, I poked him in the nose with a clothespin. Just kind of like taking the dog by the ears. What's the result of that? Who does the dog come after? The one that did the poking, right? So if we get involved in somebody's fight that's none of our business and we start poking around, it's going to get us in trouble. It's going to get us in trouble. You can tell Jared I said that when we get together next. But also better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. I think a good example of this for anyone that has been unfortunate enough to see the news, this ongoing story with Anna Nicole Smith and all of this fighting and bickering that's going on, what's that all about? Money. It's all about money. All this division is because everybody wants that house full of feasting. All this trouble and discord and disunity, all the way back for many years now, is because everybody wants that house full of feasting. And look what it's cost everybody emotionally with, as far as strife and division and discord. It says, casting lots causes contention to cease and keeps the mighty apart. A brother offended is harder to win than a strong city, and contentions are like the bars of a castle. Once strife is there, particularly like in a situation, a congregation like that, once strife is there, those divisions are there, those walls go up, those bars go up. And as was it Bobby that said that about influences destroyed, reputations are hard to repair. It takes years and years to repair the damage that can be done by strife, particularly in a congregation. And the idea is, he who loves transgressions loves strife. And we'll look at the passage, you know, by your fruits you will know them. A good tree brings forth good fruits. A bad tree brings forth bad fruits. If the result is strife, you need to look back at the motives of that person and what's proceeding out of their heart and out of their mind. And oftentimes you'll find somebody who's looking to cause trouble, who's looking to do something evil. They have an evil agenda in mind. Yeah, you can see a lot of congregations torn apart by just poor personalities. Not anything doctrinal, not anything scriptural, just poor personalities. I don't like you, you don't like me. I'm going to get people on my side. Look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. As what we find after strife has occurred is we don't find unity. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 3, Paul writes, "For you are still carnal, for where there is envy, strife, and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? For when one says, 'I am of Paul,' or in another, 'I am of Apollos,' are you not carnal?" He says, that's what strife is going to do to you. It's going to tear you apart until you're not together anymore. A couple pages back in chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians, in verse 10, "Now I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all do what? You all speak the same mind, that there be no divisions among you, but you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and the same judgment." And he goes on to talk that Chloe's household has reported what has been found among them. Contentions. They're fighting about things. They're dividing about things. There's not peace there. In verse 12, "Now I say this, that each one of you says, 'I am of Paul,' or 'I am of Apollos,' or 'I am of Cephas,' or 'I am of Christ.' Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul?" The answer there is obviously no. That wasn't the intent of all these preachers, was for each of the converts to go after whoever happened to baptize them. But that was the cause of strife there in the Corinthian body. The application for us is, once strife is there, It's been precipitated by hard feelings, by harsh words usually, something like that. How can a group of God's people worship and work together effectively where strife is present? And Mr. Bedingfield, you know, kind of brought that up just a few minutes ago. Can they do it? Can they honestly do it? Worship together effectively. Like in Colossians 3:16, where it says, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Can you do that? Well, I'm not singing to him because I don't like him because he did such and such to me, and it just goes back and forth. And several passages here that we don't have time to look at, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 25, the idea that we're all part of the body. There doesn't need to be any divisions in the body. We need to rejoice when other members have things to rejoice about. We need to be sorrowful when other members of the congregation have things to be sorrowful about. The same thing in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 13, this idea of we're all part of one body. We're to be knit together, joined together, helping one another, edifying one another, so we can be better Christians by working together. But those are some of the consequences of strife. And as I mentioned there, that passage about, you know, a good tree is going to bring forth good fruits, a bad tree is going to bring forth bad fruits. It's because the one that's causing strife, what's his motive? Well, he's looking to cause trouble. He's not doing it by accident. He's looking to cause trouble. He's seeking something for himself. He's serving himself, not serving God. Any comments about some of the things that strife will lead us to? I know we kind of rushed through that last part just a little bit. Jeremy? Yeah. But oftentimes we don't display that same attitude when we're here, when we're grown ups. We need to be forgiving. We need to try not to do that in the first place. If everybody has that attitude of edifying and building each other up, a lot of strife would disappear. Any other comments or questions, Trevor? Yeah, casting lots causes contentions to cease.
And what that says is if you do that, you're submitting yourself to the possibility that you may lose.
Yeah.
Though you may potentially be right. And coupling that with 1 Corinthians 6 about rather being suffering to fraud than to take a brother to court, one of the solutions is, that goes with Jeremy's comment, is we have to be willing to lose what may be rightfully ours.
Yeah.
We may be in a position that we may have to give up what's rightfully coming to us, and we have to decide what's more important. Coming to us, what we think is coming to us, or the name of the Lord, or peace, unity, what things are more important to us?
Yeah. If we follow, if every Christian were to do that on issues that are not bound by doctrine or scriptural things, but if every Christian were to do that, strife within churches would just disappear. Would not be there at all. That's a really, really good comment. I'm glad you brought that up. Any other comments or questions on strife or contention or anger? I know we've rushed through the last of it, but we're about out of time. If you have that handout there on Proverbs or on the Proverbs dealing with pride, we didn't get to cover any of that. Some of that is related to what we've talked about tonight. Look over that and kind of keep them under the subheadings there, and I think it will flow through there pretty well, though. Thank you for your attention tonight.